You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. We'll jump right in. And I'm Arnie Duncan, and I have an amazing brain trust here that you're going to hear a lot from, and I have a chance to ask them some questions. I'll give maybe 3 minutes of quick context for the work we're doing and why. Then we're just going to have a conversation. We're always very real. We're sometimes a little raw. And that's just, for me, it's so important that we be honest and authentic on, you know, what's working, what's not, and why. So context for Chicago and why I do this work. When I led the Chicago Public Schools for 7.5 years, by far the hardest part of my job was the number of our kids who were shot and killed. During those 7.5 years, we averaged one child being killed every 2 weeks. And going to those funerals and going to those kids' homes and going to schools where there's an empty chair and trying to make sense of the census was by far the hardest part of my job. And in hindsight, very, very naively, I thought we were rock bottom. I thought it couldn't get worse. And in the 7 years my family and I were here in D.C., things got a lot worse. And in fact, this past year, Chicago Public Schools, 40-week school year, September through June, they had 59 kids killed, so more than a child every 2 weeks killed. And these are kids in school. Last year in Chicago, there were 660 homicides, almost 3,000 people shot. There's something I'm obsessed with called the clear rate. The clear rate is the percent of crimes that get solved. In Chicago, if you kill someone, that has about a 26% clear rate. So there's a 74% chance that you literally get away with murder. If you just shoot someone and don't kill them, that has about a 3 to 4% clear rate. So it's 95, 96, 97% chance that there are no consequences. Chicago has very strict gun laws, but Chicago, unfortunately, is not an island. And we live right next to Indiana. And lots of guns pour into our community from many different places. So for me going home, this was the crisis facing the city. And the thing that's toughest for me is how I just think we've robbed our kids of their childhoods. And the level of fear that our kids live with every single day is extraordinary. They struggle to make it back and forth to school. All my life I've tried to preach, think long term and think about college. And if you're just trying to survive every day, that stuff is like a foreign language. It doesn't quite make sense. I grew up playing basketball everywhere in the South and West Sides. You can't do that anymore. Most of our parks are pretty much empty. And for me, it's just not fair. In every crisis, there's an opportunity. For me, as I started to sort of think about what to do returning home, there are two parts of the opportunity that really attracted me. One was that things are so violent, things are so bad that many of our guys are looking to change, looking to do something different, looking to get out of the street life. And two, there's a myth that folks selling drugs are making tons of money. Some are making some, but a lot of guys are risking their life, getting shot at, police are chasing them and making next to nothing. And so what we started 16 months ago, with a cohort of guys on the far south side in the Rosen Pullman community. And we found guys who were most at risk of shooting or being shot, which in Chicago, that's 75 to 80% are young black men, 17 to 24. And we hired them. And we've worked in a cohort with them, building a brotherhood, building a camaraderie. Candidly, some of our guys were shooting at each other prior to that. We had to work that through early on. We do hard skills, we do soft skills, we do trauma care, we do substance abuse. A lot of our guys have gotten high school diplomas, you'll hear about that. Two of our guys are in college now. And our goal is to keep them with us for roughly a year and then spin them off into legal economy. It's just trying to provide a pathway from the streets, and the violence inevitably starts there, into the legal economy. And we started that in September. We started working with Mr. and Mrs. Jones in March of 17. So they've been working with a group of guys for almost a year, and so it's sort of a good time to sort of reflect. And I'll just sort of stop there and just jump into the conversation and start, just go right down the line. And I don't say this lightly, I always say Mr. and Mrs. Jones are walking saints. We have six cohorts of guys now, three South Side, three West Side. The first one, we have a small team, we did it ourselves. Every other cohort has been led by community partners. Churches, nonprofits, social service agencies, our whole goal is to build capacity in communities to really take on and do this work. So I'll start with Mrs. Jones. We're just going to line up.
Sure. Good afternoon.
Little quick background and why you do this work. Turn on your mic.
Yep. Good afternoon. My name is Wendy Jones, and I am the founder and executive director of the Youth Peace Center of Roseland. It is a nonprofit organization on the far south side of Chicago. I've actually owned that building, a former Chicago public school teacher who wanted to do something different in my community but continue to help young people. And I've been there 22 years. My husband and I have worked with a number of young people in that community from elementary school all the way up to about 26 years old. And last 12 years, we've been working with older youth between the ages of 16 and 26. Then Chicago Craig came into the community, and we were so excited about helping them because usually the little funding that we get is like a drop-in 4 months or summer youth program. The funding is gone, and kids are back on the street doing the same thing that they were before that dropped in. So with Chicago Credit, it's been amazing because now we can offer young people more wraparound services, more support services, the type of services that we know that they need. So it's been really amazing, and I'm sure you'll get a chance to hear a little bit more from me, but we're going to just move it down.
So I'm Rogers Jones, and I serve as the director of operations for the Youth Peace Center, Roseland, but I'm also with these guys. I'm the dean. And so as with anything else, when it's new, young men come into the program. They want to know who are you, what you're about. And so one of the things that we give them, and the question is, are you here to change the direction of your life? If they say they are, they act like they don't know if they want to change the direction of their life, then we say stick around with us and we'll see if we can help you. We use a motto, get inspired, make a change, change your attitude and your thinking, and then you'll change your life. This helps us quite a bit. We try not to take on the mother, father feel of them, but we are our listeners. We have to listen to what they're talking. We want to preach to them. I want to hear your story. What got you into it? Where do you want to go? This has helped us, and we're continuing this work. We're very grateful for Chicago Cred, but this is not new to us. We like all type of people. We don't discriminate against anyone. We want them to do better, and we're going to work hard for them to reach that goal.
Work extraordinarily hard.
Yes.
Mr. Hicks, so one thing that is, people say we're trying to do lots of different things and there's no one simple answer to what we're trying to do. I would argue one of the most important pieces is we have a life coach for every one of our young men. And Mr. Hicks is one of our life coaches. And our life coaches have interesting backgrounds, and I'll have him talk a little bit about his background. But these are the guys who all day, every day are thinking about how we help guys move from point A to point B and take that next step. Transformation is not easy. It is not overnight. It is not linear. But before we talk about the work, Ms. Hicks, maybe talk a little bit about your background and what you used to do and what you're doing now and why and what changed. And put that mic on.
Good evening, everybody. I grew up in Roseland area, same place I'm working right now. Went through the penal system, came up through the gang life, thought it was the best thing in the world at the time. Spent over 16 years on four different stints throughout the Department of Corrections. I made a lot of mistakes, and I just thought to myself when I came home this last time that before I went in the grave or let someone kill me, I just changed on my own, started doing the right thing, ran to Mr. and Mrs. Jones, worked with a program called Ceasefire, the aims at stopping the violence, stop the shooting. Was good at that, and they gave me opportunity to interview for this life coaching job, which is a whole different world, but all in the same to stop the violence. And I'm just here to give back so they won't go through the things I went through. And a lot of times you don't understand, you just hear it, Chicago this, Chicago that. It's bigger than the words you hear. It's actuality with us, whether it's gun violence. It's almost like music to your ears every night. So I'm just here to help these little guys and found a little love for most of them. And we just striving and struggling with them till they get to the point where they can make things happen.
Take a minute. You grew up around guns, using guns, loving guns. talk about that.
Yeah, I wanted to shoot everything up, man. I'm gonna be honest with you. If you wasn't throwing up the pitchforks, wasn't from my hood, it was gonna happen for you. Didn't care who you was with. Don't care who you can go get, or what you can go get. It was a sense of invincibility. I came around guns real early, like 12, 11 years old. I'm doing shootings, running in the house. My mama don't know what's going on until eventually the police start running in behind me. So I think it's more of like an face. It's an addiction. We look at a drug addiction, but guns is an actual addiction out there. Just by hearing the shots alone, some of these guys get enthused, and it's hard once they get enthused by shooting. It's almost like New Year's. You hear it every day. I want to be the shooter. I want to shoot. And once they become addicted, you got to find the right drug and the right system to get them away from that addiction. And that's what we're doing through Chicago Cred programming, job awareness, just teaching them competency. So, you know, and I'm happy to be a part of it.
You got locked up not a couple times, but four times. And what was different the fourth time from the third time, from the second time, from the first time? What made you decide it was time to actually do something different?
I was trying at this point not to become an armed habitual. So I got two Class X's in my background. Just to give you a little insight on that, I don't know how y'all law is here, but if I was to get into another problem, I have 25 years minimum to start with. And I don't want to go that route. The 6 to 30 was enough. 85% is another thing. And to break it down in a nutshell, I think that kind of like deterred me. Because your friends ain't your friends at the end of the day. When you're in trouble, you're going to go calling for mommy and go calling for your relative. So, it's rough. Cook County Jail, it's rough. It's real rough. And we're dealing with an actual gang life that has no laws to it anymore. You know, when I came up, doing a GD through the Larry Hoover, I'm sure you heard of this name before. We had laws and policies with certain things I couldn't do. I couldn't be outside on election day selling drugs. I couldn't not be in school. I couldn't even sell drugs without somebody letting me know it was okay to sell them. So right now it's no unity, no law, no structure. But these guys are still representing something or going to war for something that was already going on before they was born. Most of these guys is 23, 24 years old. They battling stuff that happened 30 years ago that they carrying on through the legacy of their neighborhoods.
And go to Damien, maybe just talk a little, ask all three guys, just talk a little bit about what you're doing before a year ago and what you're doing now. And we'll start there. Just give a little background of what you used to be doing.
Hello, how y'all doing? I'm Damien Flandle. About a year ago, I was really doing a little bit of everything. Yeah, I was really doing a little bit of everything, like shooting, selling drugs, police steady kicking in my grandma's doors. I'm steady going back and forth to jail for just dumb stuff, really stuff over nothing, like you said, Hicks. It's just stuff from a long time ago. We just still carrying it on through the legacy. It's really, at some point, you got to realize that you're getting older, and it's just time to grow up, especially when you got kids. I got two daughters, so I've been shot up, stabbed, in jail. I just did a year and a half. It's sometimes you just gotta grow up and mature yourself. And I met Mr. Jones actually through Malik, and he asked me like, "Yeah, you in the gang?" I wanted to lie to him and tell him no. And he like, "Yeah, you shot somebody? You been shot before?" I'm like, "I've been shot before, but I don't know if I should tell you if I shot somebody." So he told me to come down the next day. I met him. I stuck with him. He was real cheerful. He was real cheerful, cracking jokes. He was somebody real comfortable I could be around. I stayed with it. Every meeting we had, I stayed up with it. Then I started getting my high school. They put me in school to get my high school diploma. I didn't think I could get my high school diploma. I dropped out of school at like sophomore year. We was in war real bad. It was school, that was the last thing on my mind. I ain't gonna lie. But they helped me get my high school diploma. That's when I really, really got motivated and dedicated to it and real reliable. Like, he can ask me to do anything, I'm gonna do it. Like, I'm a real reliable guy. So I say they helped me get my OSHA card, my food sanitation license, my driver's license. I didn't think I was gonna ever get that either. So, yeah, I just had an interview yesterday, and we got on the plane this morning, but I got the job though, so.
We did not plan that, but that worked out great. And our goal is from their cohort, our goal is to spin guys off when they're ready. So they actually have guys now already working full-time in construction. They have a guy working in a law firm, and it's Coldstone Creamery. Came in with an offer, and he'll start there soon. And again, everyone's path is different. Some guys might be with us 8 or 9 months. Some guys it might be 15, 16 months. And it's again, there's no straight path. Malik, what were you doing before? What are you doing now? What's the program been like? What's worked? What hasn't? But talk about maybe before last year.
Pretty much what I was doing a year before the program was I basically was out of control. In and out of jail, selling drugs, catching cases. It was completely out of control. And once I got into the program and began to start making a change, things start to begin to come easier to me. You know what I'm saying? Like before the program and first off, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, that's my godfather. You feel me? That's my godmama. And I got shot in 2015, 6 times. I got shot in the back of my head, my hand, and 3 times in my back. You know what I'm saying? And then I was incarcerated right after that for a gun charge. So I really didn't have no direction, and I really wasn't looking for no direction either. You know, now since I've been in the program, they pretty much didn't show me my self-worth, didn't show me it's an easier way than going out here picking up a gun, selling drugs. You ain't got to worry about it. It's real life black successful men out here that's not ducking from the police or ducking no enemies. You know what I'm saying? So they just showed me a brighter way and a brighter future. And like Damien said, I end up getting my food sanitation license, my armed security license, and a lot of other certificates and a lot of accomplishments that I then came to doing the program. So overall, I feel like I didn't do the whole 360.
Most folks in here haven't been shot. What's it like to be shot? What's it like to lie in your own blood?
Completely unexplainable. You know what I'm saying? When you questioning and asking yourself, is you finna live? Or, you know what I'm saying, am I gonna see my mama tonight? Or am I gonna make it? You know, no mother wants to bury their child. And I don't want my mother to bury me either. So it was just like, it was completely life changing. Sitting in your blood, you know what I'm saying, laying there, not knowing what's next, not knowing what's to come. So.
Malik, how many of your guys past couple years have been shot? How many have been killed?
The past 6 months, we just lost 2 friends back to back. And last week, one of my other friends just got killed. So it's an ongoing cycle that it ain't gonna stop unless we break it. You know what I'm saying? Unless we change and we make a difference in our community.
And then what made you decide to change?
I just felt like if I keep going in the direction that I was going in, I knew that I was insane. Hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like the definition of insanity is doing the same thing, expecting for a different outcome. You know what I'm saying? I know if I'm study going to jail, you feel me, stuff, incident study happened, it's not the law. It's not the police no more, it's me now. You know what I'm saying? If I'm study, bumping my head, study phone, it's not nobody else, it's me. So.
Brandon, talk a little bit about what you're doing before, how things are going now, what's your sense?
A year ago, I say I was like kind of struggling to survive in the streets. Like I ain't had no income, nobody to help me out. So it was really leaning towards selling drugs and robbing to get my money and to get the things that I wanted. And a year ago, my mama thought she was gonna have to bury me or I was gonna be in a cell somewhere. Because of the route I was taking, I got kicked out, expelled from all CPS schools. Had to go to alternative school, end up getting kicked out of an alternative school for gang fighting. It was just rough. But since then, and since the program Chicago Cred, I've been like on the righteous path, trying to do the right thing and make the right moves and right choices. Mr. and Mrs. Jones been a big help. My life coach, Mr. Hicks, been a big help, keeping me motivated, not going to retaliate when things happen to people that's close to me and my family. And that was like the hardest thing to do. A few months ago, my little brother was shot. And like, that's my little brother. We grew up together. So it was hard to like not retaliate and not go back in the streets and jeopardize myself. So Mr. Jones, Mrs. Jones, Mr. Hicks, everybody was just in my head, like, stay focused and stay on the right path and everything gonna be okay and work out for itself.
So take a minute and just walk people through, because a huge percentage of the violence in Chicago is retaliation. And these are battles that go back 15, 20 years. And the thing that's craziest to me or most heartbreaking is that the kids fighting the battles now and dying often don't even know why those battles started. And it's just what they're doing. But walk through how hard it is not to retaliate when that's how you've been trained and raised all your life, and how you struggle with that, and why do you decide ultimately not to?
I think the hardest part of not retaliating was actually when you sit down and just think about everything that's going on. Like, your thoughts be racing fast in your head to see somebody you love in that much pain and that close to dying. Like, it's hard to stay focused, and it's hard to not to go make somebody feel the same way they made your loved one feel. But the thing that kept me calm the most was my daughter. Like, she was just born. So me not wanting to lose her, miss out on her life, was the main thing that kept me focused.
For three guys, tell the audience, hardest thing about this year? What's been the toughest thing working on this year?
This year, the toughest thing to work on this year was just like I said, staying focused and keeping up the good work that we've been keeping up. Like my fellow coworkers right here, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, I helped us get handlers or certificates to build our resume and our background. Food, sanitation, my two most recent certificates is what I'm most proud of. I just got a certificate for asbestos removal and deconstruction and lead abatement. So them two certificates like boosted my ego a little bit.
Malik, hardest thing this year? Hardest part of transformation?
Like you said, the hardest thing is just staying focused. You know, when you're trying to change, you got a million one things and a million one people trying to stray you from the direction that you want to go. So the biggest thing is mind over matter. You know what I'm saying? What's a priority to you? You know what I'm saying? What's your dreams? What's your goals? You got to put yourself first. You know what I'm saying? And that's pretty much was the hardest thing, just staying on track and just staying focused and keeping my head right and not letting nobody else discourage me from the direction that I want to go.
So. Daniel, just twist a little bit that what we really try and do is create a safe environment within the group, and there hasn't been one fight all year. We had one crazy girlfriend a couple of weeks ago that wasn't one of our guys. But the guys are all going home to their same homes in the same neighborhood every single day. And we are not yet to the point of really reducing neighborhood violence, and that's what we're trying to do starting now. So this year, in the midst of all this good work, Damien, you get stabbed. And what's that like when you're trying to turn, when you're trying to change, and still that's the reality of where you live, that's the reality of your community?
I would say the hardest thing for me this year about that was retaliation. When I got stabbed, I was in the store. I didn't know what was finna happen. I turned around and it was just started a fight. It just started just right there. Me and him, we just got the fight, and I felt I was numb. My whole side was numb. I didn't know what was going on. But I came out. I had a gray hoodie on. It was. When I came out, it was my gray hoodie. I had a gray Nike. It was new too, so it was full with blood though. So I'm trying to see. I was trying to get to my grandma because my grandma RN. So I'm thinking like, okay, she gonna patch me up, and I'm just finna go kill him. So that's the only thing that was going through my head. But when I got to it, she like, nah, you need to go to the hospital like right now. I called an ambulance. I ain't even called an ambulance. I drove myself. Matter of fact, I drove myself to Roseland Hospital. Then they transferred me to Christ because my lung was punctured. So the hardest thing I say was retaliation. Like, for something to happen to me, like, I felt that was kind of crazy. It was retaliation. It was staying focused. Like, my grandma, she called Mr. Jones to try to make sure, like, keep him on the right track and keep him. You the only person that's in his head right now. You who he close to, so I thank Mr. Jones really for like everything.
Hicks, two questions. You can take them in either order. One, what's the best thing about being a life coach? What's the hardest thing about being a life coach? And then I go back to Cook County Jail every month, and we recruit guys out. We're coming out of Cook County Jail to come into our program to sort of try and stop the cycle. And two times ago, Hicks came back with me. I want to talk about life coaching part first, and then maybe what it was like to go back to a place where you had spent too much time.
Life coaching is it's not the easiest job in the world. Far from it. Hands down, it's almost unexplanatory. But just to jump in real quick, you heard these little guys talking about retaliation. So I talked to him about everything. I'm a Facebook detective. I'm all that. I need to know what's going on. I need to make sure you're cool. But when they speak of retaliation, here's what you don't understand. When they don't retaliate, they become even more of a coward than they was when whatever happened to them. So now it makes our fight even more to keep them off the streets. He gets stabbed. He don't do nothing back to these individuals. It make them want to do something else to them. That's a fight in itself, even with being shot. So life coach, it's fun. It had my fun moments, successful moments, but then it's a struggle, and I'm going to strive with them through it because I didn't have it easy. One of my worst fears is not seeing them one day, waking up, not getting a phone call. So we've been blessed. Like Arnie said, no fights, a few incidents here and there, but for the most part, it's a brotherhood. To jump to the county jail thing was one of the oddest experience that I'm actually in the county jail with my street clothes on. I'm actually on the deck. I'm on a live deck with individuals I house that, and it's something else. It's almost like being a basketball player. You never ever practice, and you finally on the court, and you got to figure like, well, why am I here? And I figured out that I had to deliver. Come to find out, three of the guys that was in the group we was talking to was from the neighborhood that I was born and raised in. And a lot of times you just got to look at these guys and you see them. Sometimes they're pants sagging. Doesn't mean they're a thug. Doesn't mean they're going to shoot you. Some of these guys are more educated than you can ever imagine. The problem is, in order to get over the perception of a person, you got to take away what you think about them. Because as you look at them, they're looking at you a certain way too. So that's it. And they already know, they never get a second chance to make a first impression. And I'm proud of my guys. And speaking of life coaches, these two are life coaches. We got other people that life coach. You guys are life coaches and probably just don't know it. It's a gift. You just got to figure out what yours is.
So our three guys, I always ask a question, and people think it's funny, but I'm dead serious. Coming into our program, pay cut or pay increase?
It was a pay cut, to be honest.
Pay cut. Yeah. Why you decided to take a pay cut? That's hard to do.
Because it was the smartest thing to do, to be honest. Like, I ain't got no more risk. I ain't got to look over my shoulders, worry about going to jail, getting robbed, or nothing like that. Work no corners, or nothing like that. I got a legal income that could be explained for if I get pulled over with some money in my pocket. I could show check stubs now. Couldn't do that when you were selling drugs. So,
Malik?
For me, I feel like it was a pay cut, but also I feel like it was worth it too at the same time, because the stuff that I had to do before the risks and the wrist and other things that I had to look out for, I don't got to look out for now. I don't got to worry about no police. I ain't got to worry about nobody robbing me. And I ain't got to worry about nobody raiding my mama's career. You know what I'm saying? So I just feel like, it was, like you said, the smartest thing I could have did was take the pay cut.
Dame? I say it was a pay increase for me. Mm-hmm. I ain't gonna lie. I say it was a pay increase because all the money, like, I had a bond out. I stayed bonding out. I got to get my grandma's doors fixed. I got kids. I don't know. I ain't know where the money, how the money, I was going to get the money. It was a pay cut. It was a pay increase. Cause I know the money coming now. I know every 2 weeks is a check that I know my car is going to be loaded. Like, this morning I woke up, my car was loaded. So, you
know. Just so the audience knows, it's usually about 50-50 with our guys. About half it's a pay cut, sometimes dramatic. About half it's a pay increase. It's just interesting. So it's different motivations. I'll go down the line. Sorry, Mrs. Jones, we'll go right down the line. Just sort of step back and sort of bigger picture. So in a perfect world, I'd love to see Chicago have no homicides. That's probably a little bit unrealistic. So what I keep saying is I just want Chicago to be more normal, not such an anomaly. And just to give you a sense of what an outlier, how insane it is right now. Chicago is, as you guys know, is the third largest city in the country. We have way more homicides and way more shootings in New York and LA combined. So think about that, number three, way more than one or two added together. For us to be normal based upon population relative to New York, right now we had 660 homicides last year, we'd have to go to 92. So we need a body count reduction of close to 500. So that's the kind of change that we need just to be normal. I wouldn't even say great, but just not such an outlier. And so let me just go sort of right down the line. I'll start with you, Mrs. Jones. Like, so big picture, stepping back, for Chicago to get to a place that is not so crazy, what's it going to take the city to do? What do we need to do?
Well, first, as the gentlemen are talking here, I'm thinking about my own sons. We're the parents of four sons. The two youngest ones have never walked to a corner store, didn't really know friends on their blocks because it was just dangerous. And this community that we're talking about, Roseland, is a predominantly African-American community that I moved into years ago. And my family was like the first black family on the block, so I've watched it change. Went to high school, went off to college, came back, put my business there. I'm committed to the community. I think it's really important. It's so easy to just move away. But I just committed, just wanted to stay there and see this thing turn around. And when I think about what's hard, it's more than just reaching the young men. It's like we have to do like a holistic approach almost, because what make young men do this? They're not just waking up in the morning and saying, you know what, I think I want to shoot somebody today, or I want to sell drugs today. There's a lot of dysfunction. And at the end of the day, I think that these young men and the other young men that live in the community want the same thing your sons and daughters want. They want a healthy life. They want to feel safe, and they want to be successful. And I think these guys are showing that. You know, if given an opportunity, they can turn their lives around. I think a lot of African-American communities across Chicago, there's a huge deficit. And we're trying to fill some of that with great programming, people that care, and opportunity. So I think it's going to take a lot more opportunity from organizations like Chicago Craig, and Chicago Craig having the resources to change more lives, to be able to touch more young men. And I think that that's a way that we could have more success.
Yes. Mr. Jones, how do we take this down at scale across the city?
Well, I think one of the things that I try to do and encourage other young not only young people, but people who are older, like myself. You know, young people, you have to really take a look at them and start listening to them. You know, I used to preach all the time, don't do this, don't do that. You know, you have to listen to their stories. You know, I'm listening to these young men right here. You know, I know who they were when they first came into the program. I know some of the things they did. That did not scare me. I'm not scared of that. I thought they came in the program because they wanted some help. It's a great honor for them to come into the program and get a high school diploma, something they wanted. They accomplished something. A lot of young people in our community, they don't finish. But it's not because they lack the intelligence. They lack someone pushing them. And I think that when we look at ourselves and we think if we come from nice homes or we didn't have our children to not go to jail, it's up to us to step back and say, let's help somebody else like somebody helped us. Somebody helped me to go to school. Someone helped me for a job. I can't look at these young men that come into our program and turn my back on them. That's not fair. Some of their circumstances were not the same, and it's important. When I see them sitting here on this panel at the Brookings Institute talking to you, expressing themselves, they're not scared. They're telling real-life stories. These things really happen in their life. But what makes me feel proud is that they have accomplished things. They've got certificates. They feel good about themselves. They got a haircut. They're smart. They have some money in their pocket. They're hungry. All of these things they do. And I'm very proud. And I think that we have to look at ourselves once more and say, you know what? Let's help organizations like CREATE. What can I do to help other young people? And I hope that you will take this and help us help others.
Hicks, how do we take it down?
I'm going to jump out. I think we need to start focusing on some of these at-risk young women. Everywhere you go, every city, every state, at-risk young men, at-risk young men. You don't realize that these men are at risk because they feuding over the same woman. I'm just being honest with you. You got rival gangs having a baby by the same woman. Unplanned parenting. I just think we focus a lot on the young men. The system already got a chokehold on them. And I mean a noose, a chokehold on them. So they already walking in fear, scared of the police, whether he got a check stub or not. He's still wondering, is he still going to bother me from a year ago when I was out there bad? So even with the ops, what they call them, the rival gangs, them guys don't care that they got a job now in the program. They don't care about none of that. They don't care about none of that. We flew all the way here to Washington. We could be anywhere in the world, but we're here with y'all. Anywhere. We came here to see y'all, to deliver. Start focusing on some of these young women.
Dame, answer either question. One, how do we take it down at scale? Or two, similar, what do you want this audience, and we're going to open it up after these three for your questions, what do you want this audience to know or think about walking out of here?
I would say, I'm going to answer the first question. I say more programs like Chicago CREATE, because now the generation now, they only joining gangs for protection, a sense of belonging, and and a lack of role model. Like Chicago CREATE, when I came in, like I kind of got like role model from my life coach and Mr. and Mrs. Jones, even though she a woman, but that she's still like a role model because, you know. Thank you. Yeah. So I would say just more programs like Chicago CREATE.
Yeah, basically what Damian said, more programs like Chicago CREATE. Because I feel like Chicago CREATE is the only program that offered us what we didn't get so far. The only program that that's guaranteeing it, that they're going to hold on to us, make sure we get jobs, make sure we got our high school diploma. The only program that gave us life coaches, gave us a therapist, you know what I'm saying? The only program. So it's like, I just feel like we need this program. We need this program to stay around to keep our youth, to keep us alive. You feel me? I feel like if you ain't busy, that's an idle mind. And once you got an idle mind, you got a million and one things to think about. How I'm finna eat, how I'm finna do this, or thinking about doing detrimental things to people. You got a million and one things to think about. So I just feel like Chicago Cred offered us so much to the point that we need to keep these programs, like to keep funding these programs, keep pushing. You know what I'm saying? We got Mr. Hicks right here that's an amazing life coach. I can call this man at 1 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock, he up. You know what I'm saying? I can call him at any time. He picking up for me. He's there for me. I tell him I'm in a predicament. I can't get myself out. He coming for me. So I just feel like this all we got right here. They take this from us. It's probably going to be more youth dead, more youth in the county, more youth in the penitentiary. This was our hope.
Brandon?
I think, like they said, we definitely should have more programs, but I think it should start younger. Like, we should reach out to the youth before they get at risk. You know what I mean? Like, start in elementary schools. The things that some people teach the youngest these days, nowadays, that's what lead to the chaos and lead to the out of control. So I feel like if we reach our youth and raise our kids the right way, the next generation will be better than our generation. Mm.
Let's open it up to the audience. You go ahead, Joe.
First of all, I want to thank you for sharing your stories. It's been very informative, and we really appreciate your doing this. So my question is for Hicks. So you mentioned that you have been in prison several times. So I'm just wondering, what is it like when you come out of prison? How do people treat you? Is there any support that is provided to you? Is it basically impossible to get a job when you have a prison record? How can we do a better job helping people come out of prison?
Nothing is impossible. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So, you got to have confidence in yourself. You know, coming home from the penitentiary or the county jail, you already missed out on something. Most guys come home low self-esteem, no money, pretty much no family to go to. You bitter. The blame game is there. You always blaming on everybody else but yourself is why you did 4 or 5 years. You just got to come home focused. You got to be ready to let go of the streets. The streets got the strongest hand grip I ever seen in life. In life, you can go from walking out the church on a Sunday to going to the store and come out a gang member. And it's just that quick because the lifestyle is so enticing. And then you got to think when you come home from prison, what is offered to someone with a parole officer tagging around everywhere you go or a probation officer? What's offered to them? What's offered to them? Here, what's offered in Washington? You got programs. Now these guys come levitate to these programs because that's all they got. It's either this or it's that. And for the most part, these guys been loyal. The 35 we had, they still strong. You got to offer them something that you never had. Like me, I never had a job. I never cared to have one. I had guns. So if I need some money, I'm gonna go get it. But when the law start changing, your mindset changed, you got to start looking. Okay, so and again, society look at criminals like they the worst in the world. There's people in here that got away with stuff. Let's be honest, you just ain't been caught. There's some guys doing time ain't do the crime. 30 years they come home, the state don't want to give them nothing compensation. So you pick your poison, but you got to understand it's something in that individual, regardless of what that piece of paper say about them. There's something deep down inside that could be brought out. You might just have to help them.
Hi, I have a question. You made a very poignant statement, and you're talking about the streets not wanting to let go. But the experiences that all of you have get under the skin. And so my question to you, all of you who are running the program, what are we doing to not only just provide the help from, you know, education and economic mobility, but also the healing that has to come with the traumas that have been experienced from the violence that all of them have experienced or been a part of?
So we're very fortunate to have an amazing psychologist on our team. Our guys also have CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. We do a lot of circles. And so we do have a team of very qualified people that are addressing the trauma with all of our young men. And it's just a part of the program and a very important piece.
I would say quickly, we're doing a ton, and I promise you we're not doing enough. And people talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. This is current. This is present. This is every single day. And for some of our guys, it's been since birth. So this stuff is deep. We do that. We have our guys write autobiographies, tell mm-hmm. their stories, which is very tough and extraordinarily powerful mm-hmm. and healing. But we're doing as much as we can in many areas, and no, we're not doing as much as we should.
If I can just say, I just want to touch on what Arnie said. We had a wonderful program where the guys actually wrote memoirs, and it was truly an amazing way for them to unload that trauma. And then we had a reading. They were able to read their stories, and they were so powerful. And it was healing as well. I wish we had brought a sample to read, but definitely a great part of our program.
Malik, I'll put you on the spot.
It's like I can't even really explain it to y'all. Being shot 6 times, and I got shot in the back of my head, my hand, my back, my arm. So it was, and to top it all off, it took me a whole year to get back completely to what I was. So it's like the trauma and the waking up in the middle of the night, I still don't sleep good all the time. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, I can't really tell you how it feel. You know what I'm saying? Like, you just have to be in my shoes to experience it. And I wouldn't want nobody to experience it. You feel, experience the pain that I felt, wondering, was I gonna come home to my mama? You know what I'm saying? And what made it so bad, my son was 4 months, and I had another girl that was 6 months pregnant with my daughter. So my kids wouldn't even would have knew me. You know what I'm saying? I wouldn't have been nothing but a figure of my kids' imagination. They wouldn't have had nothing but a picture to show I just how my daddy looked, or they wouldn't have had nothing but stories. So the trauma, can't sleep, not eating, wondering who, if this person is that person, I can't really explain it to you. You know what I'm saying? But one thing I can say, they gave me a out, you know what I'm saying? They gave me an outlet. As far as, like they said, we have a therapist, we got life coaches, we got people that's here that's trying to help us heal. You know what I'm saying? But I basically have to heal at my own pace.
Good afternoon. My name is Ebony Rose Thompson. I'm here with America's Promise Alliance. So is that loud enough? I'm sure that you all have seen all the coverage in the news around Parkland and the mass shootings and kind of that, the conversation around gun violence centering on that specific type of school violence. How do we open up the conversation so we talk about violence for all kids and for all communities? Because DC is home for me. And there are a lot of kids who look like me and look like you all in places here who face a lot of trauma and violence daily, but they're not part of that conversation. What will help open people's eyes to see that certain things just all kids should have?
I'll take this one very quickly. Just, we sent down 6 of our high school teens to spend this past Saturday with the Parkland kids, and it was transformational on both sides. And they're going to come visit us in May. The march on the 24th that Bring My Family Back, one of our high school kids is going to speak. And so we're building those bridges. And I think the diversity of that movement race, class, socioeconomic status is I'm more hopeful on this issue than I've ever been. And I'll just say the Parkland kids totally got the need, not just to invite our kids, but to have our kids help lead the movement. That's all in the back.
Hi, thank you. First and foremost, gentlemen, like you said earlier, it does take a lot of courage to, A, not retaliate, and then also be able to walk in your neighborhood where your peers and your neighbors know that you have not retaliated. So first and foremost, I salute you for being able to have the courage to be able to, you know, just walk down the street every day with your heads up. My question pertains to, are you all aware at Chicago Cred of any sort of analysis between how much a murder costs? So here in the district, we look at before the investigation of a murder, it's a little under $500,000, the cost to the city overall per murder. So have you seen any programs that have been able to measure the cost of someone being murdered to then say, listen, well, in the district, if it costs $500,000 for the city, before they even start the investigation, the prosecution, and the jailing of someone, maybe just saving one person's life, that $500,000 could be put into a program like Chicago Cred. Are you aware of programs that have made any sort of analysis in that direction? Thank you.
Yeah, and we did all that analysis before we started, but every homicide in Chicago costs the city between $1.3 and $1.4 million. A bed in Cook County jail is $55,000, $60,000 a year, and our cost per head is lower than that. So I think I can make a pretty good ROI case. And to be clear, our time with the men is basically for around a year. And the goal we'll see over time is the rest of their lives, they're in mainstream society. So this is not it's not an ongoing investment from the public sector. We're doing this all from the private side, and that's a separate conversation why Chicago isn't doing more publicly. We won't have that one today. But the ROI case, forget the heart piece of this, the emotional piece of this, the financial savings to society is staggering.
My colleague over here is out of your eyesight.
Thank you. I am on the listserv for a lot of the meetings that take place here at Brookings, and this is the first one I made sure I came to so I can greet you all and let you all know that people are thinking about you here in D.C. Mm. D.C. used to be that city with that high number. Like, we know, I don't know how many Washingtonians are in this place, but I'm a Washingtonian. So I know about the numbers. I know about the crack numbers. I know about all of that. But my question to you all, anyone can answer it. How do you feel when you see the outpouring of support when 50 people are killed and 600 are just not spoken about in Chicago? Like, everyone changes their Facebook profile when there's a mass shooting, and I just keep thinking, Chicago, what about 500? What about the 550? What about the 600? Okay, it was a mass shooting. 40 white people were killed at a concert. God bless all of them. But what about the 600 poor black people that are killed in Chicago year after year after year? Like, how do you feel about that?
I think being from Chicago is kind of like the norm to us. Out of states, it's the norm to y'all too. Oh, Chicago, turn the TV, it's another shooting. You know, and at the end of the day, I just believe, in a nutshell, that we need to pay more attention to social media. Because if you do look at these mass shootings, there was a possibility that could have been stopped. Had you looked into this social media or looked into this text or looked into that, we overlook the smallest thing and then it becomes huge. So as far as Chicago, we of course we sick of it. I'm sick of hearing Gatlin's with all. We got a funeral home that literally got a drive through. You do not have to get out your car. You can drive like a Burger King. You want to see your partner? Pull up, roll your window down, look, and keep going. So I mean, who getting the money? You know, the people selling the caskets, I'm sure they don't have a problem with it. It's just us. They not the ones getting put in the casket. It's sad. Oh, I don't want to hear nothing about no school shooting, mass shooting, white or black. It's still sad because most of them innocent. They ain't had nothing to do with nothing. Could you imagine somebody running in here right now with assault rifles? What are you going to do? It's unimaginable. We never think it could happen to us. And that's why the program is so good. Because we don't got guys that just think they're invincible anymore. They may have came to the program thinking they were invincible. And then they started thinking, you know what, I do have kids. I can do something better. And that's what everybody got to do. Sometimes you got to look within that mirror. That mirror mean a lot. That mirror you look at every morning, mean, don't wash your face only. Talk to yourself. Talk to yourself.
Hi, Anand Sharma with the Center for the Study of Social Policy. You mentioned working with community organizations and just curious about some of the strengths that those community organizations build, bring, and also some of the biggest capacity building needs to be able to allow other organizations to do this kind of work.
So
thank
you. Why don't you just talk about where you guys are?
So yeah, you know, one of the things that I realize in doing this work is that there are some resources in our community. I think one of the biggest challenges has been connecting the youth to these resources. I can remember just going to my local park and being able to participate in a number of different things that I carry with me through the course of my career. Everything that I did from volleyball, tap, modern dance, all of those great services that I got as a kid carried me in life. And at that time, they weren't calling that person, that instructor, a mentor. It was just the volleyball coach or whatever. I think that I'm going to answer your question. I think it's just so important that we figure out better ways to connect our kids to all of these resources, because a child that is connected is less likely to be involved in incidences of violence. And my agency is a very small agency, and we have pretty much networked with larger agencies in the community that would get funding. But again, the biggest challenge has been that funding was just so small, you know, just for just only touch, just the tip of a issue with a kid. And so you just giving some kid a little money for the summer. And then, but the major issues still continue. And I think that we have to think about various ways to help build capacity with smaller agencies, because a lot of times there are small agencies that are doing big work. And so Chicago Craig has been definitely a huge part of helping us build capacity. I think that once this is over, we'll be able to sustain ourselves even longer and to continue to help a lot of young people in the community. And also, whenever our agency has always partnered, it didn't matter the size of funding we get, we always figured out a way to share with other agencies in our community. If someone gave us something, we would bring as many as 8 to 10 partners in, so that everybody, because we can't serve all the children, but those eight partners are serving 100 kids one way or another. So now we're serving 800 kids opposed to us just serving 50 kids in our agency. So building capacity is huge. People working together is huge. Thank you for your question.
I want to add one quick thing to that, though. If it happens and they don't give us the money, sometime, some kind of way, we make it happen. Mm-hmm. It's the work. We're dedicated to this work.
We've or you it do it without times. The money.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And we have.
Right. I know we have to close. We could talk all day here. Just three quick final thoughts. First, I always say programs don't change lives. It's relationships. Absolutely. And it's not just these three relationships towards the other three. What our young men do to support each other and move in a different way is remarkable. Another guy not here basically had his family massacred this summer at a family picnic. Horrific. And it was his peers who kept him from retaliating and life coaches. But it's relationships, not programs, that always change lives. Secondly, people often say, oh, it's great you're giving guys a second chance. I think, honestly, for many of our guys, it's a first chance. And they're making a rational choice now because they never had other better rational choices. No one has to work with us. No one's assigned by the courts or probation officers. For every cohort, we have people say, how do you find guys? We have massive waiting lists. What's your waiting list right now, the next group?
About 75 people.
Looking to get in. We have another one of our cohorts has 168 in the waiting list, and we're trying to scale fast and reach a lot more guys because they're looking to get help. And the final thing I'll say is, I think you guys feel this today, that these guys aren't the problem in Chicago. They're actually the solution. And I'm actually wildly optimistic about where we're going to go as a city. And us here are going to try and do our little part to help, but it's going to be these young guys putting down their guns, talking to their friends, bringing in the next group that ultimately is going to lead the city to a wildly different place. And I can't prove it. We'll come back. But 4 or 5 years from now, I'm convinced as a city, we're going to be dramatically better. And it's because of their leadership. Please give them a round of applause. Yeah.